This is Public Radio from the Joseph S. Sample Studios at MSU Billings, KEMC, and from the John W. Fisher Studio at the Bozeman Public Library, KBMC, in Gillette, KYPR, and KECC in Miles City.
We are supported by Montana River Action, an all-volunteer watchdog organization protecting Montana's rivers and streams. Information on water issues and the health of state waters is available on the web at montanariveraction.org.
Good evening. I'm Jackie Yamanaka, news director here at Yellowstone Public Radio. In the studio with us also, Jim Gransbury, my colleague, agricultural and political reporter of the Billings Gazette. And we are preempting tonight's regularly scheduled program, your opinion, please, because we have a special guest joining us. We'd like to welcome Senator Conrad Burns, who is back home during this August recess.
Thank you.
Thank you for stopping by.
Nice to be here.
In a few moments, we will go ahead and open up our phone lines. I'll give you those numbers, though, right now. In Billings, 657-2941, 1-800-441-2941. Senator, I'd like to start off the conversation tonight and just ask you about the latest developments in Montana's gubernatorial race. The incumbent, Judy Mart, said she won't run for re-election next year. Your thoughts on that?
Starting to get fun.
It's a reporter's delight.
You guys will sell more newspapers. Yeah, I tell you what, and everyone will just simply be glued to the radios and their TVs as we go into this season.
Were you surprised by that announcement?
I really didn't know what to expect. I know Judy and I had talked a lot because she happens to be a very close personal friend.
She used to work for your office.
She worked in our office, and she headed our office in Butte, Montana, and did it very capably, and she was terrific. I learned a long time ago that Judy Martz has a mind of her own, and she does what she thinks is right and what her heart tells her. I guess I was kind of surprised, and yet I wasn't surprised. It was sort of a mixed feeling, but she's made the decision, and I think a lot of weight has come off her shoulders now. She's got another year and six months or so, and I think she'll take good advantage of that, and she's a good administrator. She's just a good administrator.
Okay. I want to move on. I mean, during the August recess, one of the things that the Congress had to do before it went on an August recess was pass an energy bill. And what passed basically was, or what was agreed upon, was the Democrats' version from the previous year, it's my understanding, in the Senate. This bill is going to go to conference committee when you come back. What are you hearing from Montanans about an energy bill? You know, we hear the news. There's a shortage of natural gas. We're seeing gasoline prices, for example, go up.
Well, no, I think we need a national energy policy. And I would tell you that I think, you know, the only reason we passed that bill, I think the minority leader got up to make a political statement and made a little deal, and they took it.
Well,
to the surprise of the minority leader,
he knew that you folks wanted to leave town just as much as he did.
Well, I think that's true, but the Wednesday night when we melted down, you know, and that's kind of when that happened. There was a controlled crash here, and I was sitting on the floor, and a lot of us were. And because there was supposed to be a series of votes, so the thing went to melt down, and I said, you know, I don't think we're going to vote tonight. So I walked off of the floor of the Senate and on my way to the office because I'm going to go home. And
you were going to get on a plane, literally.
No.
Okay.
I would to my house,
okay,
and which is only 10 minutes away from the office. So the guy, a reporter for ABC Radio, and I know you've heard of him, Vic Ratner, and he walked up to me and he said, Conrad, what in the world is going on the floor? Because they broke into this judge fight. And if nothing attracts a lot of attention to the great debaters, that is the debate over judges. And so he said, what is in the world is going on in there? And I said, well, I think it's kind of like a daycare that run out of raisins. And
you're describing you are describing the greatest liberty of body in the universe.
Well,
as a daycare center.
Well, it sort of had that. It took on that sort of characteristic, you know. And
a well-dressed daycare, though.
Huh?
A well-dressed daycare.
Well, yeah, they were. Most of them were pretty fancily dressed. But anyway, but it attracted a lot of that. And basically, I think the American, I don't know who was watching on C-SPAN, but whoever watched that, I know was kind of disappointed in the Senate, and I was too. And so what I do, I don't try to get caught up in that sort of a situation, and I just go to the House and quit for the day. And besides that, you know, Phyllis is already in. My wife is already in Montana. She's been in Montana since the 1st of July. And she was boiling over here. And back there, we were cool and having rain all the time. You know, so I guess it all plays out for the best.
Well, I have to ask you, you know, in terms of an energy bill.
Okay, the energy bill, I think the bill that left the Senate will not look like that when it comes back as in a conference report. I think there will be will hold some pretty strong conservation measures. I think and besides that, you know, the car companies now have made peace with California, and now I think that'll spread across the nation, and I think that's good in the area of not only conservation but emissions. And we wanted to see that happen if we could, but we also need production. We are not in the end of the hydrogen age yet. We are a good solid 10 years away from that. And so we're still going to be dependent on fossil fuels in the near future to power this economy. And now, but that doesn't mean they might not be pure fossil fuel. There's going to be hybrids and this type thing. And I think the car companies are going to move forward on that. We had a great demonstration. I drove one the other day. And so I think we'll have a lot of that, but we must, and I think even what went on in New York now with this brownout, I guess it was more than just a brownout. I haven't heard the details
yet.
I haven't heard any of the details, haven't gotten any of the details yet. So, we know that we're not going to build another nuclear plant. But we're going to try to set up the framework of which nuclear power can be reinstalled and used. That has a chance, I think, a little chance of passing. And I think now we're looking. Guess what, folks? Because of the cost, we're looking at coal again. And
I'm glad you brought that up because the idea we're using scarce natural gas to fire electrical generating plants, in a word, is insane.
Well,
we're using a very valuable, expensive fuel that should be used for the production of pharmaceuticals, fertilizers.
You bet.
And the heating of homes, which traditionally has been the relatively inexpensive form of heating the home, and we haven't had a problem in terms of supply when natural gas was deregulated in the early 80s.
Yep.
But to use that now to produce electricity when we got 500 years worth of coal, in a word, is insane.
Well, Jim, but you know, every power plant, design plant out of the past 5 years is designed as gas-fired plants. So we know it's there. Mm-hmm. Now the conversion, I don't know what the conversion will be, and you know, and I would tell you that we should be looking at this coal because
in the bill that might encourage a more rapid development of low sulfur coal in Montana.
Well, we still hold on. We held on to all of our money for clean coal technology, Jim. Mm-hmm. And also, there will be, if it comes to pass, there will be a coal, a generator that will be coal and with a mixture of gas. There's some new technology on the line now that during heavy air concentrations, we can switch from one to the other. So there's a lot of things out there, but it's got to happen. And of course, they say, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And right now, I would take a look at the Northeast and say, necessity is.
What else do you think that the energy bill will have in terms of Montana, Wyoming? Certainly, the Powder River Basin, the Rocky Mountain Front.
I think there should be access to those areas, and I think we'll lighten the access on that. Although we'll be very aware of any environmental damage. I'm not worried about that. But you know, we don't gain anything by locking lands away. You know, there may come a day when we ought to know what's there, for sure what's there. And under national emergency or whatever, we should know. And so we want it on the shelf if we've got it. That doesn't mean we have to use it.
What about our Canadian friends? They have in northern Alberta the tar sands, which if the appropriate technology is used would make the...
Bless you.
The Albertans, the replacement for the Saudis.
Well, of course, they're already ready for that. You know, I got the biggest kick on when the Prime Minister of Canada didn't want us to drill in Anwar, and yet you just go right across the line in Northern Territories. They've got gas and oil wells clear across Northern Territory, just to the east of the Canadian Alaskan line boundary. And they've also got a pipeline that that can get it to Edmonton. And
you mean he's looking out for his vested interest?
I wouldn't be a bit surprised there wasn't a little vested interest there. But, you know, I'm not going to blame him for that. I'm not going to blame him. That's politics and that's national marketing.
Well, and also, you know, much of Montana's gas...
Right now
and formerly was of Canadian origin.
Sure. Sure, but that all goes on this balance of payments we hear about.
Right, right. Well, let's go to our phone lines and take a call from Cutbank. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, thank you. Good evening, Senator and Jackie and Jim.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. In spite of all this heat.
A little warm up there?
Oh, yes. It's up in the 90s. I don't know just wherever that has been anyway.
Well, we'll come on down here where you can really warm up.
Hey, oh, no, thanks. It's just too much now. What I want to talk a little about, Senator, is especially in the last few years, we've had these horrible forest fires. I don't know if you remember the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the 30s. It was the CCC camps, as it was known. It got the youth off of the city streets and out into a nice, clean environment, and it did a lot of good work in the forest, cleaning them out and so on. Why can't we get that going again? Now, that was under the auspices of the Army officers. Also, the kids learn discipline from the Army, but I suppose it'd be under the foresters now because they're the ones equipped to teach the kids what to do and so on. But it was a very good and very worthy thing for the country and for the youth. And it got them away, and today we get them away from the drug pushers and all that kind of crap that's going on in our cities, and even extend it to girls as far as that goes, have girl camps to do some work like that. And to get the youth employed and get them in good constructive employment, it's good, clean, healthy outdoor living, and do a lot of wonderful good work in our forest. And this is what we're hollering about today. I don't want to see the timber companies go in there because all they can think of is clear cut. And we all hate clear cutting, and that's why we don't like the timber companies. They won't select cut. They always want a clear cut. That ruins the ground, the environment, and silts up the streams, and God knows what all. Now, the other thing you just mentioned is, why can't we tell the oil companies to go to blazes, quit dragging that dirty old oil over from the Middle East, and go to alcohol? Our farmers would be, oh man, well off, and a renewable resource that does not pollute. Now, Indianapolis Speedway has used alcohol fuel for years, and very successfully, of course. Why can't we go to alcohol fuel? It's renewable, and our farmers here would just be so happy. Anything that ferments, you know, will make alcohol, beet, sugar, or the beets, barley, oats, corn, anything.
Okay.
Well, and so on. Now, I'll hang up and thank you for listening.
You bet, and thank you for calling. We appreciate that. Now, I'm going to take the ethanol. We'll still have our ethanol credits, and I'll tell you what, ethanol is being more used more now than any time in the history of transportation fuels. It is the largest user right now of non-livestock feed production. In other words, they are putting as much corn in ethanol as they are in the livestock feed. Now, the other component of that corn is, guess who? Human feed. Now, how much do you want to pay for cornflakes?
There's no relationship between the price of corn and cornflakes.
Or wheat and Wheaties.
And Wheaties. and we have that directly from the vice president of grain procurement of General Mills, who spoke right here on this campus about 2 years ago and made that statement. There's no relationship between the price of commodities and what you pay in the grocery store for boxed cereal.
I think you're exactly right, because when we have to pay $4 a pound for a box of Wheaties and we can't get $2.75 for a 60-pound bushel of wheat, you are right. There cannot be. The price of grain has no effect.
There's a disconnect, yes.
There's a disconnect. No, but I would tell you that we are moving towards a ethanol and methane powered cars probably as fast as any other nation in the world. Now, but I will tell you that we are there again. The infrastructure of providing that fuel, as handy as a oil companies has now for gasolines, are oxygenated and our lead free gas. The infrastructure has to grow with it. And it's like, you know, they tried to use natural gas for transportation fuels, but they didn't have the infrastructure in which to handle the natural gas.
Right.
So now we can do that. And but you're right. Now, let's go to the top part of your question.
The CCC.
Sadly, I remember the CCC camps. And you are right. But political correctness got in the way. In this country. In other words, those were folks who were really looking for work. It was in the depth of the Depression. Unemployment was very, very high. And a lot of those folks took us not only took the CCC camps, but they also worked in WPA. And of course, there'll be a lot of folks that said this is the way that Roosevelt drug the country out of a depression, when basically there were some other factors. I don't know whether Jim's going to live or not. Are you going to live?
Yes.
Sadly, he's going to make it. but anyway, so all at once we got these ideas that we've got to pay these folks. Now we got Job Corps, America Corps, all of this, and they've turned in to be terribly managed and very expensive, and we got them working, putting up fence for ball fields when we ought to have them in the forest, and there is a community out there that don't want them out there, and I would say that political correctness has not served us well when it comes to talking to a volunteer corps or some place for a young man or young woman to get some experience of manual labor. And we're going to go to obesity, but you guys will laugh at me.
Now, before you leave there, you know, did you listen to what the Surgeon General told you yesterday?
I did.
Okay. Obesity in America is a very, very serious health hazard.
It is.
And don't be belittling that, because if we engender a program of avoided cost, your colleague yesterday, Senator Craig from Idaho, said that if we enforced healthful protocols for chronic diseases, we could cut Medicare by 45%.
That's right. He's right, too. I saw those same things.
So
I'm trying to lose, Jim.
It's not
you
too
have
bad.
A pedometer?
Huh?
Do you have a pedometer that counts your steps?
Yeah, they gave me one yesterday. You know how many steps I took yesterday? I was shocked. 2,200 steps.
Does that translate to miles? Do they have a little gauge
no,
on there?
No, it doesn't. It just says steps. So you got to figure you at least did that average 2 feet.
Right.
Maybe
you're
sometime.
Supposed to get 10,000. According to Tommy Thompson.
Let's not tell you that.
You're going to have to. You're going to have to work hard.
You're asking a little too much now.
Joining us in our studio this evening, U.S. Senator Conrad Burns. He's home for the August recess, and in our studios to take your questions this evening. Let's go now to a caller from Shepherd. Thank you so much for waiting, sir.
Hi, Conrad.
How are you?
Oh, pretty fair. I tried to get hold of Myron in D.C. today, but he was out somewhere. So I'll ask you the question. Related to the last caller, why can't a governor use the well-regulated militia and providing for the general welfare to make a sawmill owner a colonel in the militia and then give him directions, him or her directions, as to what to do as far as clearing out the forest? For instance, clearing out all the old fire roads of so that you can get back into them, clearing out the dead brush, dead wood and underbrush 500 yards from each side of those fire roads and the old logging roads, and just remove the dead and diseased trees. And I would think under the Constitution, since those rights are reserved to the state, that it would be possible for a governor, should he or she have a little intestinal fortitude, to take on the federal government and do that. And I don't see anything that would stop him.
Nothing more than a tidal wave of lawyers.
I don't think I want to touch
it. No, go for it, because this gentleman raises a legitimate question about the 10th Amendment and the powers reserved to the states. He has a legitimate question, and in the context of his question, it's not illogical, although I can just see the lawyers lining up for that one.
Well, I think the only, you know what we do in our state forest lands, our state forest lands are managed much better, mm-hmm. cleaned up much better. But then, you know, you're talking about a national forest. Mm-hmm. And I'm not real sure that the states have jurisdiction to order militia in on a national forest. And I'd have to take a look at that. You may have the United States Army standing up there in the middle of that road, preventing that militia from opening that road, because it would be treated as a federal reservation.
Well, there is one thing about that.
Take me further.
If you go back to old Andy Jackson, and I'm sure that you're a student of history, he was ordered by the Supreme Court to not evacuate the Cherokee from North Carolina. And he wanted to do it because he had some friends that wanted their land, and he said, who the heck's going to stop me from doing it? Whereas if President Bush were to say, I think it's a good idea and I'm not going to send the troops in, it comes down to an executive order to send in those troops to stop the governor from doing it. I don't think Mr. President Bush would do it.
I don't know. We're getting pretty subjective here. The question. I understand the question.
There is not a really good solid body of law or case law concerning what is the extent and limits of the 10th Amendment. It's been kind of ignored until the last two decades. There has been an increased emphasis on the rights reserved to the states as per the 10th Amendment. And what the gentleman is suggesting would provide a wonderful test case as to what is the extent and the limits of the rights reserved to the state and the executive power of the governor of any of the 50 states.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for the question.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I really like the question. And it's I'm in the middle of a very interesting book right now, and I don't know whether you've read it or not. Jim does a lot of reading and does a lot of history. A Wilderness So Immense. It's by John Kukla, Kukla. It is a history of the Louisiana Purchase. And it takes and it starts in 1785 when Jefferson was the ambassador to France. Adams was in King James court in England, and there was a cabal of folks here that was trying to make some trades with the Spaniards for access to the Spanish ports, because Spain's fleet was very, very strong at that time, as you well know. They controlled all of South America, Central America, Florida, and through the Caribbean. So King Carlos III sent his number one ambassador over here to do business with Rufus King of Massachusetts and John Jay of New York, and I've forgotten the guy's name in Rhode Island. But they decided that they would trade to Spain permanent status in New Orleans to control the navigation on the Mississippi River if they would give New York and Boston access to the Spanish ports. And so Gardaqui comes over here, and he negotiates that. And it was James Monroe that sniffed a rat, and he and a young man by the name of Pinckney from South Carolina broke it up. But the main plan was that New York and Massachusetts was going to pull from the Confederation, of the Articles of Confederation, because this is before the Constitution was ratified. And it's a very interesting and intriguing book about, you know, we almost fell apart before we got together, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Senator, we have a caller from a payphone in Billings, so we'll go ahead and...
Time's a ticket.
Go ahead.
Hi, Senator?
Yes, sir.
Pleasure to talk with you. Hey, I was curious about your take on...
That's a cell phone.
You're going to have to speak up. You must be on a cell phone.
No, I'm at a phone. But anyway, when Vice President Cheney was in town the other week, the city of Billings came up with a $15,000 bill for the extra security and so forth for that. And it was there was a thing in the paper about that it was going to be a private affair, and I was wondering if the Republican Party is planning to reimburse the city of Billings for the cost and the American taxpayer in general for the use of Air Force Two jumping around the country raising money for the Republicans.
Well, number one, they pay for the operation of Air Force Two. And I don't think there's a city or entity across the nation who has ever, even on a private fundraiser plus business or versi vice, has ever been, there is some money changes hands, but it's very unlikely. I don't know of an entity that has ever done that.
And for others' benefit, I don't know if they were able to hear through the static of the phone call. The question was, when the vice president was in Billings recently for a private fundraiser, would the city of Billings be reimbursed?
I think it was around, $15,000?
$15,500, yes.
Yeah, something
it
like
was
that.
For added security, and almost every member of the Billings Police Force was on duty.
Yep.
Let's go now to a call from Helena.
Conrad, hi, Rick Gratz from Northern Rockies Publishing.
How are you?
Pretty good. Conrad, I know you've pretty well known for listening and respecting the voices of people in Montana, and I know you care what local officials think. In the case of the Rocky Mountain Front, I think you're aware a majority of Montanans have come out opposing any drilling there, and I know recently Randy Gray, mayor of Great Falls, and all the county commissioners have sent a letter to the delegation showing their opposition to drilling and supporting Max's Front Amendment. So basically, with all this local input and some pretty good, well-respected geologic opinions that there isn't that much gas there and hardly any oil, what is your feeling? Do you think there's better places we can drill in Montana? Can we put more emphasis on energy conservation? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, we've always put some emphasis on conservation, but it would seem to me now, and I'm not a very intelligent person, but it would seem to me that if you have the production of gas to the north of the border into Alberta under similar circumstances and a similar geological formation of the overthrust, how they explain the overthrust. There's some areas up in the Rocky Mountain front I definitely wouldn't want any drilling. But there are areas where that is expanded out to areas where we may have great deposits of natural gas. And if that be the case, then I think why not at least know that it's there in case we have to have it. And there's no doubt in my mind that one of these days that we're going to take a look at natural gas, and it's just like Jim said a little while ago, not in transportation fuels, but how we heat our homes, maybe not even for that, but for fertilizers and pharmaceuticals. Natural gas is used in a multitude of ways in our chemicals across the country, and it's one of the cleanest fuels that we have. And I'm not on record of favoring of setting the front aside, but I'm also on record saying, you know, there are probably areas up there that each permit's got to be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
So and what does that mean, then, in terms of Max Baucus's, what he's trying to do? I mean, are you going to oppose it? Are you going to support it? Are you going to work to kill it?
I'm not going to work to do anything. I don't think I would support the proposal. And of just blanking, and then he wants to set aside some land up on the Blackfoot Reservation. I think that's for those people to make the decision on, is those folks that live on the Blackfoot, and have jurisdiction there. I think that's their choice.
Are we talking about the
Badger 2 Medicine?
Yeah, I believe in the past the Native Americans up there have indicated that they don't want.
Well, they've had a moratorium on it, right. and so there's been nothing done.
Maybe we should just for a second explain the overthrust belt. I thought you did a good job there, and you shouldn't say to your listeners out here that you're not intelligent. It's just you should tell them that you're ignorant of that subject. Okay, and that just means you don't know about that particular thing. You're right about the geological formation of the overthrust belt. And among the petroleum geologists, they believe that this formation, which has produced large amounts of natural gas elsewhere, has also trapped large amounts of natural gas along the Rocky Mountain front in the state of Montana. There have been some test wells drilled. The Ballards here in Billings have done some testing over the years, but there's not been extensive test drilling. And what I think you're arguing for is that in some places we ought to test and see if, in fact, there is natural gas in these geological formations. This is just another one of those complex issues here in Montana that we argue over, or actually we have rock fights over, and we never resolve anything. And we can, you know, it's whether it's the overthrust belt or grazing or wilderness area or cleaning out the forests. We just seem to enjoy jawing each other and never getting anything done. Let's go to the...
Well, while we're on the subject, in a sense, on Canada and the U.S., I want to ask you about reopening the border
to beef.
To beef and beef products.
We've been talking to a lot of folks this week, ever since that announcement on Friday, which kind of caught me off guard. I've talked to J.B. Penn, who is Assistant Secretary, and I've not talked to the Secretary herself. I talked to Bill Hawks today. There's a lot of moving parts here. We have been told last week, now I had the ambassador to Japan from this country in my office, Howard Baker, about 3 weeks ago in my office. And we talked about this. He's working very closely with the Canadian ambassador. They're working on the Japanese, export situation. It makes no sense for Japan to have an embargo on Canadian beef and then we allow Canadian beef into this country, and then we get slapped with an embargo in this country. And so here we are with no export market, and we've got our own domestic supply that's building up, and that's a blueprint disaster. Same would be true with South Korea. So anyway, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of State worked out this verification program for meat coming to Japan. In other words, it had to be slaughtered here as American cattle. Now, you're talking about country of origin labeling.
Right.
We're going to have it, and we don't even need the legislation.
The Japanese are going to impose by fiat both country of origin labeling and traceability of individual animals
That's
in the
right.
United States,
That's right.
whether we
now,
want it or not.
Now, listen, but this is not to say. Now, this is not to say that we don't have a problem up there, because this is a cloud up there that's hanging over us like a big heavy tar blanket, and so we've got to figure out. In other words, we've got to go with straight science. Now, what they've announced is cattle muscle cuts and a few cattle under 30 months old, under a sealed and controlled effort. Will be allowed to start moving towards the United States after they have public comment and after they have written the rules on how to do it.
It won't happen before the end of August.
That's exactly right. Now, live cattle, no
live cattle,
no slaughter bulls, no slaughter cows, no feeder cattle. And let's face it, they estimate around 1.4 million head of feeder cattle to come to market in the next 45 days in Canada, in Alberta alone, I would imagine.
Yeah, we're getting into the fall marketing season.
That's right,
here,
in Canada.
And there's nowhere for them to go. The feedlots can't take them because the feedlots can't move the animals that they have.
That's right. Now, under the verification program. Now, I will tell you this, that the Packers really got upset Monday in Kansas City. I heard that Tyson really kind of, they balked at the idea. But I tell you, I think Bill Hawks and the Department of Agriculture stood their ground. And now that's what Bill tells me. Now, there's not going to be anything come south of that border until all the moving parts have been coordinated and they're glued down. So I am uneasy about it. I know consumer groups have also signed off on the idea. They were in the Department of Agriculture. They presented them what they wanted to do, and they signed off on it. That does not mean that they'll come out here and not somebody take advantage of some propaganda a little bit. But I also, you got to remember another thing. American packers are backed up in orders for beef loins going into the Toronto and Montreal areas because of consumer reaction in Canada on their own meat. Now, that tells me we've got a situation here that could be very explosive.
What you want to remember here is that it would behoove the powers that be in the United States to be careful what sort of conditions that we impose upon the Canadians and the Japanese and anyone else, because one of these days we might find one of those mad cows on this side of the border.
Well, there's always that possibility. Nothing's impossible, Jim. Nothing's impossible.
See, because so far that one mad cow in northern Alberta has thrown a total clinker in the world beef trade.
Well, no, just like it in England and France.
On a basis of perception only.
That's right.
Let's go now to a call from Helena. Caller?
Hello?
Yes.
I had to get my phone out of my pocket.
Oh.
Thank you. First, I just want to make a statement that I think it's an absolute disgrace that Congress has not had country of origin labeling laws in place for our food decades ago. This is a basic consumer right to know where your food comes from, and then the consumer can make up his mind if he wants to buy meat from Canada or Argentina or wherever it comes from. And this The fact is that the packers and the grocery retailers have stalled this. And Congress, who is supposed to be looking out for the people of this country, have not been doing it. The other issue I want to touch on is the so-called country of, or excuse me, my needle stuck, the so-called Healthy Forest Initiative. We had a couple of callers earlier talking about getting in there and cleaning out the forest, and we need to do this and we need to do that, and we need to listen to our professional forest managers. Well, the fact is, the Forest Service has for decades lost hundreds of millions of dollars per year on its timber sales program. It's the tabs picked up by the taxpayers. And this has been done mainly for political reasons. It's a big pork barrel for congressmen and senators to hand out these favors to the timber industry. And tell me, if you can, what on earth the fires in the Missouri Breaks or the fires down there by Big Timber have to do with logging and cleaning out the forest? Absolutely nothing. It's burning because it's hot and it's dry, just the same as it's burning in Portugal and all over the world because it's dry. And it's quite clear to a great many people that this Healthy Forest Initiative is mainly a ploy to cut out citizens' input on how they want their forest managed. And we hear all this talk time after time, when it suits the purposes of whoever, about local control. We have to have local input. And then when the people stand up and actually say what we want, and it doesn't fit in with the scheme, we're ignored. People have said, we don't want drilling on the Rocky Mountain front. People have said, we don't want snowmobiles in Yellowstone Park. And do the people get what they say they want? No, they don't. They get overturned every damn time. So that's my rant for the night. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, caller.
And we appreciate it.
Okay.
The gentleman does a very good job of giving us a litany of several of the controversial subjects in which, and especially on the drilling in the forest vis-a-vis Ms. Flores' decision of several years ago. And the overwhelming public comment was, we don't want it. And the political machinations have swirled around that. And his frustration is justifiable.
Well, let me ask you this, Conrad.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman is not alone.
No, that's right.
And, you know, he doesn't have a high-powered lobbyist to come visit you in Washington, D.C.
I'll tell you what.
So
he's the most powerful lobbyist I've heard tonight.
So, you know, where...
all the others.
I mean, this is the question people think about. Do their voices matter?
Sure they matter.
And you take that back with you when you go on the floor and vote?
Oh, yeah. Sure you do. In some cases, you do. Some cases, you do not. And I think it's a case-by-case basis on the question and where we're arguing about. Sure, you listen to the folks here, and then you weigh that against what you know. And I will tell you, I want to give you, for instance, do you realize there are now people paying sheep people to graze the forest now, and some of their pastures to clean up the underbrush? And where we've had grazing years and years ago, we didn't have fires like this. Now, I want to grant him one thing. He's very perceptive in this thing. We have not had weather like this, Jim Gransbury, since the 30s. And if
maybe
we
ever.
That's right. We could be going into the driest season that this country.
We're getting close to the record in days.
Yeah, that's right.
We started keeping records in 1882, and I believe by the end of the summer, the record, what's happening this summer in Montana, Definitely show us.
That's right. Now, in dry years,
dry.
No matter what kind of a management practice you use, you're going to have some fires. But I will tell you, on normal years, when you take a look at fuel load, at thinning, other words, it takes a lot of moisture now to sustain that forest up there, especially where the regrowth is starting to come back, and they need thinning. The amount of moisture it takes to sustain that growth. And so it dries out much faster. So I would say and some areas where we clear cut, we actually improve the forest. And all we gotta do is walk through those regrowth areas. I mean, there's some great examples of regrowth of our national forests. But we never see them. We never see them. And I'm sorry that they don't photograph them and we put them on parade a little more. But I will tell you that I think it's on a kind of a case by case basis. That's the way we ran our farm, and that's kind of the way they run ranches. And I'm telling you, these ranches wouldn't be worth a nickel if they weren't managed some way or other for their grass. And now, sure, we had fires up here in the Missouri breaks. Sure, they didn't log in there. But it's also the hottest part of that fire was on the CMR, where they've taken grazing out of there. I mean, they just pulled those permits, and I can show you where we've grazed and cut that. But on Mount Jumbo in Missoula, or not Jumbo, I got the money so they could buy this little chunk of land up there. Is it Mount Jumbo? I guess it might be.
I think so. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's right, yeah.
And so it was the right thing to do. I've made more land trades than probably any other senator that's ever served there in Montana. Taylor Fork, North Fork. We've set aside a lot of land since I've been there. But it's been on a case-by-case basis. And so they're paying sheepmen to eat those weeds off in spotted gnat, leafy spurge, and to get some of that undergrowth off there. And that's just above the University of Montana up there, Jim.
Right.
And you know exactly where it's at. So, you know, the practice on every chunk of land cannot be managed the same. In other words, it has differences. It has different soil types. It has different growth. And whenever we blanket, say if we appeal, just on a blanket appeal giving no real reason, then that's not the way to manage it either. So I will agree with him this. I think the Forest Service has to rebuild a little bit of trust for the sins, of our fathers, so to speak. But they're not allowed to be doing that. They can come out here with a management plan, and before they even get it put in place to see if it works or not, it's appealed, and it's never carried out. So we can't go through that. What I'm saying is, let's look at a chunk of Mother Earth, and let's make and regard and base it on science and manage it according to that science. And I think we can. If we were farming today, like we were farming in the 30s, Jim, do you realize there wouldn't be nothing but rocks left in this state coming in this 5-year drought and then ending in a year like this?
It had all blown to North Dakota.
That's exactly right. It had all been in North Dakota, and not one real estate agent would have got commissioned on the dirt that left the state.
What do I call it? We got callers backed up here, so we better get to them.
We're trying. Let's go down to a caller in Billings. Thank you for waiting.
You betcha. I initially called when I heard Mr. Burns. How you doing tonight, Mr. Burns?
I'm fine. Mister is not the name. It's Conrad. It's August. It's break time.
All righty. Let's see. I heard you make a comment about the AmeriCorps program and how poorly managed it is. And I think, you know, especially with you being a public figure, that when someone talks about a certain program, you got to be kind of careful to not paint a whole program with a bad brush. AmeriCorps here, I did 2 years of it myself here in Montana with the Montana Conservation Corps. And these are great people. They're out there in the woods doing a lot of work for a lot of different agencies, BLM, NDRC, the National Park Service, the Forest Service. And we do a lot of work that otherwise these cash-strapped agencies would not be able to get done. It installs a public service ethic in these people that they carry on with them for the rest of their lives, probably more so than a lot of other folks who go right to college and go right to a business job. And at the same time, the work's not just out there in the woods. It was the hardest 2 years of work in my life, I'll have to say. But at the same time, these programs are working out, trying to expand literacy among underprivileged children. They're doing out there doing a lot of good things.
Well, now, I'm going to agree with you on that, and nobody supported that more than I did. In fact, I would tell you that the whole backbone was Mark Roscoe and I and a guy by the name of Harris Walford.
And I met all these people back then when I was doing the program.
You are, and I was very supportive. But you know, I don't know whether you know what happened or not, but they went through an audit, and it was terrible. And it hurt the local programs that were being managed as they should have been managed, such as they were here in Montana. And I will agree with you, we've had the best management people of anybody in the country. But this is not, here in Montana is not where the problem is. And,
but still, despite an overwhelming majority of the governors of the country, when they all met together, almost every governor who had an AmeriCorps program in their state, they all agreed that by the time it was done, the program still provided the most bang for their buck for public service. All the governors, basically, virtually all the governors who met at the last National Governors Conference, wanted AmeriCorps to carry on. I mean, just about any agency will have management problems and audit problems.
And
you can't use that as a reason to say, well, the program is poorly managed, let's move on.
Well, no, it's going to exist because they're going to go through this. They're going to go through extremely hard times in the next, I'd say this year, next year. And we will see them through that because we got them some money in a supplemental just so they could survive. And I was a principal sponsor of that. But I'm telling you, they've got to clean the house and where they got to clean it is right there in that 17 square miles of logic free environment. And it hurt all the programs nationally. And I'm sorry about that. Because they did do a lot of good things, and I've been on sites here, and you know that. And I even got an award for it, for the support of AmeriCorps and what they were doing. And I did speak sort of out of turn, but too broadly. And I'll admit that. But boy, they have got a big problem, in the management in that thing in Washington, D.C.
All right. Thank you, caller, very much. Let's go now to a call from Helena. Hello.
Hello. Good evening, Senator Burns.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I had some questions regarding the possible distortion of evidence that led us into Iraq, and wondered if you also share those concerns.
Well, you always have concerns. The toughest vote that you give any president is the vote to use force. And you've always got concerns about that based on the information that we had at that time and the information that's been revealed. I still do not in any way feel badly about my vote. I just don't. I think whenever we're still looking for weapons of mass destruction in a desert where he buried a whole Air Force, MiGs, his whole Air Force was buried out there. We just found him, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? You didn't see much of that in the press, did you?
Oh, yeah. It was there.
Oh, it was there. Yeah. But it didn't make a big thing. And you find graves, mass graves. We found out that his infrastructure now, he controlled his people by the rationing of central services, sewer, water, electricity. That's the way he controlled his population.
The one point I'd like to make is I don't believe we were sold a war based on humanitarian reasons. I think we were it was weapons of mass destruction.
There's no question about that. There's no question about that. But
if I might finish, it
yes.
now appears to be a moving target because now it's eroded to a weapons program. And I think we were told that it was an imminent threat, that the danger, we could no longer wait. The danger was so great that could be attacked within 45 minutes. And I think those are certainly appear to be exaggerations at this point in time. And all I'm asking is, shouldn't we be applying the same standards for investigation that we might have on previous president? I think they would have skinned him alive.
Well, I don't think so.
Oh, yes, they would have.
From what I know, and I'm not going to divulge all that I know, but I will tell you this. Ask the Kurds. Ask the Iranians. We know now, since we've gone in there, that he was totally unprepared. He did not think that we would do what we did. There was charges on every oil well in Iraq, not every one of them, but the vast majority of them, that were not even wired together because he thought he had time as long as the UN was debating. And we were trying to work with our allies. So the coalition forces went in. And I would tell you that the neighbors of Saddam Hussein had the same fears. The Kuwaitis, the Saudis, all of them knew that he had these weapons. He had a way to produce them, and he wasn't afraid to use them under circumstances with the Kurds and with the Iranians.
And again, that would be not something that was told to us as a reason to go to war. And you hear of people such as Zimmerman in the Washington Post today, who's an analyst and a physicist, as well as Joseph Wilson, disputing these facts. And they appear to, when somebody comes out and says that the intelligence does not match what we were told early on, then there seems to be retribution, such as the outing of Valerie Plame, who is apparently a CIA operative, and I would think that certainly is an illegal act. Actually, it is an illegal act. And those I'm saying is, shouldn't we be applying the standards that we may have done under a previous president? And I don't see that being the case. And I think Montanans are an independent lot, and we should be asking intelligent questions and giving this critical thought.
Well, we just fall down on a different line on this, and my thinking and what I know and what I think is in this president's heart, and knowing the circumstances of the previous administration, I feel very comfortable with my vote, and I feel very comfortable with what we're doing for the people of Iraq right now. I just do. It's time for Americans to come together and to walk step by step with these the Iraqians that to bring some freedom and some things that they have been denied for the last 25 years. It is time now that we pull together.
Well, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that, and I hope for the best.
Yep, and I think it will be the best too, because
I have some different concern, and I don't see that this country is pulling together. I see it as unfortunately a very dark period, and I'm not so sure that history will judge this period very well.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And let's, Senator, try to get in one last call for the evening. Let's go now to Bozeman. Hello? Hello, Bozeman? I guess they're not there.
We've been spared.
Want to thank you so much for spending the last hour with us, taking questions and comments from those of us here in the studio, me and Jim Gransbury of the Billings Gazette.
Jackie, I always enjoy you, and I enjoy my good friend Jim Gransbury over here, and we don't always agree on everything, but I think it makes great dialogue.
Well, you might want to know that one of our photographers has a great propaganda picture that your office would probably want a big blow-up of, but it's a picture of you and I talking yesterday, and of course, I talk with my hands, as you well know, and it appears that Jim Gransbury is about to strangle the U.S. Senator. So you may want to make an inquiry for future reference there.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a great country, and I enjoy representing the state of Montana, and I think those values that really build us and I will continue to do that as long as I draw a breath. I change, but I'm slow to change. And because I got a little history behind what I do too. And of course, history is a blueprint to the future, and I read it every day.
And you're always welcome back, as long along with your colleagues in the Montana Congressional Delegation. Should mention that coming up, hopefully this fall, Jim Gransbury and I will be launching a new series of discussions about science and public policy. You mentioned science several times tonight, and in terms of issues like forest health, oil and gas, I mean, we can go on and on. And we'd like to, Jim and I would like to take a deeper examination of that topic through a series of programs. We're lining up the guests now, and so stay tuned for that. And with that, I'd like to say goodnight, Jim Gransbury, Senator Conrad Burns.
Thank you.
Also, thank you very much this evening to Ken Siebert and Guy Moody for their technical assistance with this program. Good night.
KEMC from the Joseph S. Sample Studios at Montana State University, Billings, and KBMC from the John W. Fisher Studio at the Bozeman Public Library, KYPR Gillette, and KECC Miles City.
This program is supported by Radiant Engineering of Bozeman, providing energy-efficient radiant floor heating systems and other comprehensive energy solutions in Montana since 1979. On the web at radiantengineering.com.